Thomas Cromwell was Henry VIII's chief minister throughout much of the 1530s, one of the most formative periods in English history. Yet, one of the most interesting things about Cromwell himself is that he actually came from very humble origins. His father was a Putney blacksmith and brewer. Yet Cromwell rose to become the most powerful man in England after the king. So how exactly did Cromwell achieve this, particularly given that the 16th century was a period when society was very hierarchical, very structured, and people tend to knew their place? In order to answer this, I think we need to go back and look at Cromwell's early life and his rise to power under the king. Frustratingly, we know very little about Cromwell's earliest life. We know that he was born in Putney, probably around 1485, and that his father was a blacksmith and brewer there. At some unknown point in Cromwell's youth, he left England and spent time working abroad in Italy and Flanders, working in a variety of legal and administrative roles. By about 1520, he was back in England and he'd established himself working as a lawyer and merchant. Significantly, in 1524, Cromwell's skills as a lawyer then attracted the attention of Henry VIII's first chief minister, Cardinal Thomas Wolsey. And Cromwell essentially became Wolsey's man of business, working on a variety of the Cardinal's private legal affairs. In 1529, however, disaster strikes because Wolsey falls from power, having failed to secure Henry VIII's divorce from Catherine of Aragon. And there was a very real danger in 1529 that Cromwell might suffer as a result of his fallen master. However, rather than abandoning Wolsey, as many others did in 1529, Cromwell actually remains remarkably loyal to him, and he's able to act as a sort of go-between between Wolsey and Henry VIII. And it's really this proximity to the king which enables Cromwell to make a favourable impression on Henry, and he quickly enters the king's services and is appointed to the king's council at the end of 1530. Over the next few years, Cromwell works his way up to a prominent position on the king's council by handling all sorts of administrative tasks connected with governing the realm. But Cromwell's real talent, the reason he's so appealing to the king, if you like, is that he is a practical man who can get things done. And undoubtedly, the most significant job which Cromwell does for Henry VIII during his first few years as a royal counsellor is his role in securing Henry VIII's break with Rome. Now, many earlier historians actually thought that it was Cromwell who first suggested to the king that he should break with the papacy, establish himself as head of the English church in order to enable him to divorce Catherine of Aragon and marry Anne Boleyn. More recent historians, however, John Guy and George Bernard, for instance, have all emphasised that the ideas of sovereignty and the relationship between church and state, which really lay at the heart of the break with Rome, were all present well before Cromwell was working for the king. Cromwell's significance regarding the break with Rome is he's the royal minister who utilises these concepts of sovereignty and uses it to draft much of the legislation which enables the break with Rome. So he helps draft the Supplication Against the Ordinaries in 1532 and, most significantly, the Act in Restraints of Appeals in 1533. And it's really this act which creates the break with Rome by declaring that this realm of England is an empire governed by one supreme head. And that really means that England is a sovereign nation state. In doing this, Cromwell not only gives Henry VIII the ability to marry Anne Boleyn, but he also gives the king immense power over the church. And as a result of all this success, Cromwell secures the king's confidence and becomes Henry's chief minister, probably in late 1532, perhaps early 1533. Once he's established as the king's chief minister, throughout the remainder of the 1530s, Cromwell is active in virtually every aspect of government. And what I'd like to talk about now are some of the key areas where Cromwell is at work and to discuss some of the reforms and the changes which he helps to bring about. If we start first with the religious changes which take place, probably the most notable changes in the 1530s are the religious changes. At the beginning of the 1530s, England is still a Catholic country. Obedient to the Pope in Rome, But as we've just heard, in 1533, Henry breaks with Rome and establishes himself as head of the church in England. And it's Cromwell who drafts much of the parliamentary legislation which enabled the king to do this. In 1535, he's then appointed the king's vicegerent in spirituals, which basically made Cromwell Henry VIII's deputy as head of the English church. And using these powers, Cromwell helped the king to pass a number of injunctions which clarified and altered religious doctrine in the Church of England. So in 1536, you get the Ten Articles passed, which very slightly moved religious doctrine towards a Lutheran acceptance of justification through faith in Christ alone. There are other injunctions which outlaw shrines and pilgrimages and criticise religious iconography. The monasteries are also attacked. Now, some historians would argue that Cromwell actually steered England towards a more Protestant religious policy, more so than the king himself wanted to take. And it's certainly widely accepted among historians that Cromwell himself was a committed Protestant, although exactly what kind of Protestant is generally less agreed upon. Some historians have argued that Cromwell was a Lutheran, which is to say that he believed in justification through faith in Christ alone. Others have suggested that he was a sacramentarian, which means that he denied the real presence of Christ during the Eucharist. And certainly on his fall from power in 1540, Cromwell was accused of being a sacramentarian. Yet Cromwell's religious beliefs are actually extremely difficult to determine. His will, written in 1529 for instance, is actually very traditional and orthodox, and suggests that by that date at least, he still held many fairly traditional Catholic religious beliefs. We also have an inventory of Cromwell's house, which shows that he continued to possess many traditional religious paintings during the 1530s. And many of Cromwell's friends during these years, such as the Attorney General Christopher Hales, were also still fairly traditional Catholics. Ultimately, I think one would have to conclude that Cromwell was certainly closer to the new Reformed faith than he was to traditional Catholicism. Certainly, many of the people in his household were religious reformers, and many evangelicals looked to Cromwell for patronage and support. But I think I would perhaps take a slight issue with some of the claims that he almost recklessly advanced the Protestant cause and pushed religious policy beyond that which the king himself would countenance. Having said that, Cromwell did play a key role in advancing the cause of an English Bible, and this undoubtedly provides the strongest evidence that Cromwell did sympathise with the religious reformers. There can be no doubt that Cromwell was personally and deeply committed to an English Bible. In John Fox's Acts and Monuments, which was written around about the middle of the 16th century, so a little after Cromwell's life, Fox claimed that Cromwell's whole life was nothing else but a continual care and travail how to advance and further the right knowledge of the gospel. And according to Archbishop Thomas Cranmer, it was Cromwell who personally persuaded Henry VIII to authorise the Bible in English. And Cromwell even put up £400 of his own money towards the production and printing of the English Bible. And copies of the English Bible were ordered to be placed in every parish church. So there can be no doubt that Cromwell was instrumental in the production of an English Bible, and also that this was a significant religious change in England, and also a significant cultural change as well. Another of the more dramatic religious changes which took place in the 1530s was the dissolution of the monasteries, which began in 1536. There were about 800 monasteries in England at the beginning of Henry VIII's reign, and that would mean that no matter where you were in the country, you were probably no further than about half an hour's walk from a monastic house. And monasteries were not merely religious institutions, they were also great landowners, as well as being involved in hospitality, charities, scholarship and education. Yet in the space of just 4 years, between 1536 and 1540, all of the monasteries in England and Wales were closed and dissolved, and their money and lands went to the king. So it really was a very visible and dramatic change which occurred, and it was a change which Thomas Cromwell was very much involved with. I mentioned in 1535 that Cromwell had been appointed the king's vicegerent in spirituals, and using these powers, Cromwell sent out commissioners to investigate the condition of monasteries in England. Some of the reports Cromwell had back emphasised some corruption and malpractices in some of the monasteries in England, and Cromwell used this information to blacken the monastery's reputation and to persuade Parliament to pass the Dissolution Act in 1536. Cromwell's often remembered as the hammer of the monks, and the popular view often given of him is that he had it in for the monasteries right from the outset, and that he persuaded a greedy king to dissolve them by showing him the wealth that he could get his hands on if he dissolved the monasteries. However, it does seem unlikely, to my mind, that Cromwell, or the king for that matter, initially envisaged the complete suppression of every single monastic house. I do think some case can be made for seeing the initial dissolutions in 1536 as being partially motivated by genuine desire to reform the monasteries. During the 15th and early 16th century, there had been very widespread concerns that monasteries were no longer fulfilling their spiritual and pastoral role in the world. And equally, there had been examples of monasteries being dissolved before and their lands and wealth being put to better use. Cromwell himself had helped Cardinal Wolsey to dissolve about 30 monasteries in the 1520s for the purpose of using them to establish educational foundations at colleges at Oxford and in Ipswich. Equally interesting is that the Dissolution Act of 1536 actually only dissolved the smaller monasteries, and they were defined as those with an income of less than £200 or with less than 20 inhabitants. The Act actually stressed the vitality of the larger monasteries, which might be an unusual thing to do if you were always intending to go on to dissolve the larger monasteries, but the Act actually stressed the vitality of the larger monasteries and praised them as being places for godly religion. Ultimately, however, the wealth of the larger monasteries, combined with the leading role that many of the monastic houses played in the rebellion against Henry VIII's religious policies in 1536, which is known as the Pilgrimage of Grace, effectively sealed the fate of the larger monasteries, and by 1540 all of these were closed too. Cromwell probably had a slightly different design on the proceeds from the dissolution of the monasteries than the king did. Cromwell, it would seem, planned to use the wealth obtained from the dissolution to create a permanent landed endowment which would strengthen the crown, along the lines argued by Sir John Fortescue during the 15th century. By contrast, Henry VIII decided to sell most of the monastic lands at market value, and he used the money from the proceeds to fund his wars against France and Scotland during the 1540s. I'd like to move away slightly from the religious changes now, if I may, and to examine some of Cromwell's other work in government. With all of the religious changes which took place, the crown needed to defend and justify what it was doing, and Cromwell showed himself to be particularly adept at what we might now call PR, or propaganda. So alongside his work drafting the legislation which enabled the break with Rome and his role in the religious changes, Cromwell was also heavily involved in the propaganda campaign required to justify this. So one of the things Cromwell did was to recruit a number of prominent radicals, scholars who were prepared to attack the papacy, and he acted as patron for many of them. So, for instance, he helped fund the printing of William Marshall's Donation of Constantine and a translation of the work of Marsilius of Padua. Both of these works were thoroughly anti-papal, and so the idea was that they were printed and dispersed throughout the towns and cities in England to try and convince the people of the righteousness of what Henry VIII was doing in breaking with the papacy. Proclamations declaring and outlining the Acts of Appeals were also ordered to be printed and pinned to church doors throughout the realm so that the literate people could read and understand them. And Cromwell also organised a preaching campaign with bishops and priests ordered to go out and preach the supremacy to their congregations throughout the realm. This was probably the most effective propaganda tool that Cromwell initiated, at least in terms of the number of people who would actually hear the message, because obviously the printed material that the government produced could only be understood by those who could read it. The unanswerable question in all of this is just how effective Cromwell's PR and propaganda drive really was. Because with the benefit of hindsight, we know that the royal supremacy ultimately survives, it's all too easy to assume that the crown's message was passively and readily accepted by 16th century men and women. This almost certainly wasn't the case. People generally do need to be convinced of the arguments which the Crown was putting forward, and in many instances, people actually opposed what Cromwell and the King were doing, and therefore, by implication, the arguments and propaganda that they were put forward to justify it. Because of this, other more coercive methods were therefore required to ensure that the radical changes of the 1530s were successful. And that brings us on rather neatly to Cromwell's role and reputation as Henry VIII's enforcer. Cromwell's role in enforcing the political and religious changes of the 1530s is amply testified to by the contents of his correspondence, which are now found in the state papers at the National Archives in Kew. And reports of seditious speech and talk were sent to him. Copies of books attacking the king were also sent to him. And he was kept closely informed on prisoners held in the Tower of London. As well as this, he maintained a close eye on the licensing of preachers in the localities. His efforts in doing all of this were once seen as the opening stages of a reign of terror which spanned the entire decade. R.B. Merriman, in particular, claimed that Cromwell created a system of espionage the most brutal and effective that England had ever seen. However, these claims are largely unsupported. It's certainly true that Cromwell did make use of spies, although there are only a handful of documented instances in which he can be shown to have done so. Instead, really, the picture which emerges from Cromwell's correspondence is that he and the government were relying, as the government always had done in England, on the cooperation of the nobility and the gentry in the regions and the localities in order to maintain law and order there and to report opposition. One area where Cromwell was particularly successful with regards to enforcement was through legislation. In 1534, he passed an Act of Succession in Parliament, which required all of the king's subjects to swear to the legitimacy of the king's marriage to Anne Boleyn. This was enforced throughout the realm. Everybody had to take an oath swearing to the succession, and it was the refusal by Thomas More and John Fisher to swear to this oath which eventually led to their execution. Cromwell also redrafted the legislation governing treason in England, and in 1534 he brought forward a new treason law which extended the law's existing scope to now make it treasonous and therefore punishable by death to speak maliciously against the king. Now, this really was a significant and quite an innovative change. Admittedly, words had been construed as constituting treason in a handful of cases in the 15th century. But the Act of 1534 now explicitly stated this. Before, it had very much been a matter for judges to interpret whether words spoken proved that somebody had the intent or was imagining the king's death. The 1534 Act, therefore, removed any ambiguity in the law, and this was greatly to the Crown's advantage and potentially made a mere passing comment derogatory to the king punishable by death. Cromwell has been put forward by G.R. Elton as the person who had proposed making words maliciously spoken against the king treasonous. Whether one individual person was responsible for these particular elements of the Treason Act is slightly unclear, and I think it would be more reasonable to attribute the changes to the ongoing dialogue between the king, his ministers, and the Crown's legal advisers. Certainly, however, Cromwell was closely involved. His handwriting can be found on drafts of the treason legislation, and it's very hard to avoid the conclusion that he played a important role in altering the law to suit the government's own ends. And from the sort of perspective of the 21st century, obviously, it's a rather unpalatable Act and doesn't reflect particularly well on Cromwell. In order to provide some balance to this rather negative view that we're left with, perhaps we should also look at Cromwell's efforts to reform the Commonweal, or the Commonwealth of the realm. Cromwell spent much of his time in government drafting reforms to try and improve the Commonwealth. He kept lists of memoranda, or remembrances as he liked to call them, which were essentially to-do lists, or things to be discussed with the king when Cromwell was next at court. Many of these included plans to introduce reforms in education, in agriculture, trade, industry, and poor relief. Cromwell also employed a number of prominent intellectuals in his household, including men like Thomas Starkey, William Marshall, and Richard Morrison, all who helped him to develop reformist ideas for him to implement. Now, admittedly, not everything Cromwell tried to implement was successful. He had very little success in fixing the food prices during the 1530s, for instance. But he did introduce a number of lasting initiatives, most impressively the poor relief legislation of 1536, which made parishes responsible for measures to combat local poverty. He also took action against enclosures, which had been a long-standing problem in Tudor England, albeit with slightly less success. He also made efforts at promoting the export of English cloth. These were all modest successes, it's true, and there was little here which was notably significant, but it does at least provide some examples of Cromwell trying to grapple with social problems in England during the 16th century. If we move now more directly on to Cromwell's work in government, one of the most famous and enduring debates which surrounds the Tudor period is whether Thomas Cromwell was responsible for a revolution in government during the 1530s. This was an argument first made in 1953 by Geoffrey Elton, who argued that Cromwell was personally responsible for a deliberate change in the way in which English government was organised. According to Elton, Cromwell replaced the existing medieval household system of government with a more modern structure of bureaucratic departments. So financial matters supposedly now fell to national institutions rather than to the king's personal servants and household officers who had administered this before 1530. And central to this supposed revolution was also a reorganised and reconfigured Privy Council, which Elton argued was given a permanent and fixed membership by Cromwell in the mid-1530s and overall control of all other government departments. Elton's claim that there was a revolution in government during the 1530s orchestrated by Cromwell has aroused quite considerable debates, and many historians, including David Starkey and John Guy, have all sought to reassess just how novel the changes which Cromwell brought about were when placed within a much broader context of administrative change. Many of the changes which Cromwell brought about in government in the 1530s, such as the creation of the Court of Augmentations, which dealt with the proceeds from the dissolution of the monasteries, were simply quite obvious and necessary responses to a particular situation. It's very difficult to see it as being revolutionary. And most historians now, I think, would acknowledge that Cromwell was clearly an administrator with exceptional skill and energy, but they would seek to place him within a much broader context and long-term perspective of change in government and financial administration. Much of the work that Cromwell did in the 1530s, for instance, clearly built on the work which Wolsey had done in government during the 1520s. Indeed, Cromwell's reorganisation of the council in 1536 was modelled on a blueprint which Wolsey himself had devised in the 1520s. Ultimately, therefore, the changes of the 1530s should be seen as a further revival in the strength of royal government, which had actually been begun by the Yorkist kings in the 15th century and continued into the 16th by the early Tudor monarchs. Another notable political and administrative change undertaken by Cromwell was the enormous increase in power and control from central governments. The kingdom which Henry VIII had inherited in 1509 was not a particularly united one, and one of Cromwell's most impressive accomplishments was the extension of royal control and authority over the rest of Henry VIII's territories. And if we just take a look at each of these individually, starting first with Ireland, Cromwell achieved modest success in Ireland, which had always been a very difficult area for the English to control, particularly as English influence there didn't really stretch much further than beyond the English pale. However, Cromwell did manage to secure the acceptance in Ireland of the royal supremacy, and through the Irish Parliament, he was able to pass all of the major English reform legislation, as well as having the Earl of Kildare attainted for treason following a major rebellion there in 1534. In the north of England, Cromwell began to curtail many of the liberties and freedoms those regions had long enjoyed. Owing to its geographic location, far from Westminster, the north of England was an area where royal authority was relatively weak, and some areas even had their own sets of laws, separate and distinct from English common law. Cromwell used Parliament to chip away at some of these freedoms. So in 1536, he had an act passed which reserved all pardons for treasons and felonies exclusively to the Crown. And this act also stipulated that all judges and justices of any kind were to be appointed only by the King. This effectively ended the independence of many areas, in particular the County Palatine of Durham. Following the Great Northern Rebellion in 1536, known as the Pilgrimage of Grace, Cromwell also established a new council in the north, which was given a permanent body of officials appointed and controlled from Westminster, and this had authority over the five northern counties. So really for the first time, the north was being administered much more effectively from Westminster. In Wales, Cromwell's attempts at strengthening royal authority were probably most successful. He appointed his close friend, Rowland Lee, who was the Bishop of Coventry and Lichfield, as president of the Council in the Marches, and Lee worked very closely with Cromwell to reduce the Marches to order. Most importantly, in 1536, Cromwell passed the Act of Union with Wales, which ended the freedoms and liberties of the Marches and extended the full operation of English law into Wales. Now, one could argue that this act largely reaffirmed the de facto union between England and Wales, which had existed since the reign of Edward I. But the Welsh now enjoyed the same rights under law as their English neighbours, and they were also given 24 seats in the English Parliament. Parliamentary representation was also similarly extended to Calais as well, which was one of Henry VIII's French territories. Individually, the changes which Cromwell brought about in Ireland, in the north of England, in Wales and in Calais weren't particularly remarkable. Considered collectively, however, and when one also considers that these changes were initiated within the space of about 4 years, they become much more impressive and certainly suggest that Cromwell was particularly successful at increasing royal authority and control over the King's territories. Before we draw a conclusion on Cromwell's legacy, it's also worth, I think, commenting on Cromwell's relationship with the King himself. There's been a long-standing debate between historians about who was really responsible for the changes and the reform which took place in the 1530s. Was it Henry VIII or was it the King's minister, Thomas Cromwell? Well, for G.R. Elton was under no illusion that it was Thomas Cromwell who was responsible for the changes in the 1530s. Elton saw Henry VIII perhaps not as a weak king, but certainly a king who was quite easily manipulated and led by powerful ministers such as Cromwell. According to Elton, anything innovative done in the 1530s was instigated and done by Thomas Cromwell. Other historians have taken the totally opposite view to this. So George Bernard, for instance, has argued that actually Henry VIII was the dominant personality in his reign and also firmly in control and directing policy. And Cromwell, because of this, is therefore seen by historians such as George Bernard as being nothing more really than the king's hardworking and obedient servant. So Cromwell's relationship with the king has been and always will be the subject of much debate, but I do think that we can draw one or two conclusions about the relationship between the two men. Certainly, as Henry VIII's chief minister, Cromwell occupied a position quite different to that enjoyed by Wolsey only a few years before. Henry VIII's break with Rome and the establishment of his royal supremacy had made the king much more active in government, and Cromwell probably enjoyed less independence over the formulation of government policy than Wolsey had only a few years before him. I still think it's best to see the relationship between Henry VIII and Cromwell during the 1530s as something of a partnership, with the two men often working with one another to resolve problems and to achieve desired outcomes. If there was a partnership between the king and his minister, however, it was a partnership in which the king was very much the senior partner and also a highly active one. It was Henry who directed the broad thrust of policy and who was responsible for many of the key decisions. But Henry VIII was also a king who accomplished a great deal because he was willing to delegate tasks to trusted and talented ministers such as Cromwell. Cromwell did therefore have a significant degree of freedom, but generally this was over the implementation of policy rather than its formulation, particularly over areas which the king was perhaps less interested in than others. So, for instance, Henry VIII was quite happy for Cromwell to take more of a lead on social matters, such as legislating for enclosure, but anything which concerned things like foreign policy, religion, or the king's new powers as head of the English Church, Henry VIII was much more involved, and consequently, Cromwell had less independence over what he was able to do. Thomas Cromwell falls from power in July 1540, and nobody's really been able to offer a satisfactory explanation as to exactly why he falls from power. Some historians have suggested that his involvement arranging Henry VIII's marriage to Anne of Cleves may have had something to do with this. Cromwell arranged this marriage to try and boost England's diplomatic ties with some of the German states, and the marriage is very unsuccessful and quickly ends in divorce. And this may have undermined Henry's confidence and trust in Cromwell, but the problem is the dates for that don't really tally up. The Cleves marriage occurs in 1539, Cromwell doesn't fall from power until almost a year later in mid-1540. Another possible reason is that Cromwell's political opponents on the King's Council, particularly the Duke of Norfolk and Stephen Gardiner, the Bishop of Winchester, may have acted against Cromwell and been able to manipulate and persuade the King that Cromwell had overstepped the mark and that he was ripe for a fall. Ultimately, whatever the reason for Cromwell's fall from power, it was the King's decision to move against his chief minister which meant that he was arrested and fell from power. And when he's executed in 1540, it means that he's only been in government for about 10 years. He joined the King's services in 1530 and he's executed in 1540. And his ministry, really, is only from 1532 until 1540. So there's only really 8 years where he's seriously in power under Henry VIII. Yet those 8 years contain some of the most momentous and significant events in English history, and it's surely no coincidence that they occur under Thomas Cromwell. Offering a neat conclusion of Cromwell's legacy is rather difficult, however, because it was both destructive and constructive. It was destructive in the sense that he played a key role in ending England's centuries-old obedience to Rome. He had begun the process of dismantling traditional religion, and he helped to destroy every single monastery in England and Wales. And that act alone is, I think, very hard to view as anything beyond an extraordinary act of vandalism. However, Cromwell also established the monarch as head of the English Church, something which continues to this day. He helped to put England on the path of becoming a Protestant country. He was almost personally responsible for the publication of an English Bible, which was not only a significant religious development, but also a significant cultural development too. Cromwell also used Parliament to alter the structure of the English state, something which greatly contributed to Parliament's growing importance and significance in national life. The 8 years of Cromwell's ministry truly were an extremely formative period in English history, and as one Tudor historian has put it, Cromwell himself has left a deeper mark on the history of England than have many of her monarchs. For that reason, he remains an extremely significant figure in English history.